right. That's right. Decisions Enforced, all right? That's Outer National. And that song just gets me up every damn time, so that's why we play it every time we're on the air, all right? And someday we're going to just play the whole thing real loud, and we're just going to have everybody all across the country, all through the city, all across the country where people are listening and people that are listening after the show, and they're just going to blow their minds listening to the whole thing, all right? So that's enough on that. All right, we have a packed show for you today, and I'm really excited about it. At the back end of the show, it's really important. At the back end of the show, we're going to be doing a segment called Justice for AJ, and it's about AJ Weber. He's a young man who was killed by the LA County sheriffs back in early February, and it's about the struggle for justice for AJ and what people have been doing around that, the struggle they've had, what they're going up against now, and we'll be talking with the family and friends of AJ. All right. Opening the show up, however, I'm really pleased to welcome to the show two activists who have been involved in the disruption of the calm sea. The seas are no longer calm, okay? They've dared to stick their heads in and their hands in and their mouth in and their beliefs in and their desire to fight against fascism and the creeping fascism and the fascism that's already begun to sink roots and to stand up against it. And one is a refusefascism.org activist, and the other is from the Revolution Club. And their names are Tala. Tala's from the Revolution Club. Tala, welcome to the show.
Hi.
Thank you. Sure. And the other person is Emma, and Emma is with Refuse Fascism. Emma, welcome to the show.
Hi, Michael. Thanks for having us.
Sure. What I want to do is I want to play a real quick clip for a couple of minutes just to give people a sense of what we're going to be talking about today, all right? So we're going to play that clip, and we'll be right back with you.
Steve Mnuchin and the Trump-Pence regime's arrest spree continues. Monday, March 5th, when two young women went to read a challenge to debate directed at Mnuchin in front of the Treasury building, they were illegitimately arrested. Why were they challenging Mnuchin to debate? Because last week, when he spoke at UCLA, several other young people were arrested and dragged out for daring to challenge him.
You're talking about being a beacon for hope and freedom and democracy? That's bullshit. We all know that's bullshit. We know that the tax bill and what that represents is sentencing people to death, including children. You are punishing them for the misery that this system, the system that you're enforcing, is committing. And so, okay.
Just stand by. Look at what they're doing to people who oppressed it. He is a part of a regime which is hell-bent on consolidating fascism.
Demand the release of the Refuse Fascism members currently in jail in D.C. Demand the charges be dropped against the UCLA protesters. Demand that Steve the Mouse Mnuchin show up to debate and answer for his crimes, not send his critics out in handcuffs.
Me and my fellow disruptors are challenging Steve the Mouse Mnuchin to a debate. Since the public didn't get to hear the speech that he suppressed because of his thin skin and his aversion to people telling the truth, we want to give him a second chance to justify his cruel, life-destroying budget and tax bill and the whole fascist regime that he is representing. He can go ahead and bring his alternative facts. He can bring his wagon of deadly BS. Let's see if he can find a spine and channel his inner Marie Antoinette. Mouse Mnuchin, we will wipe the floor with you in a debate. Anytime, anywhere. You'll be standing on the interests of your band of fascist troglodytes, and we'll be standing on the interests of the 7 billion people on this planet.
All right. You couldn't ask for a better way to start, all right? So thank you, folks. Thank you for giving us that. The Mouse Mnuchin. Okay, here you go. That's a good one. Tala, let's start with you because, you know, there's a lot that's been going on here, and I want people to understand what happened when you went to see, when you went to this Mnuchin appearing at UCLA, and he's going to be giving a big speech, and he's getting all the welcomes and honors and all this stuff, and a whole lot of people showed up to oppose him. But let's talk about, so let people know, though, what happened.
Yeah, so Mnuchin was going to speak at UCLA. He was invited by the Buerkle Center for International Relations, and he was going to talk about his fascist tax bill and all of the things. And we went there, and there were people outside who are eating cake dressed up as Marie Antoinette and Louis the 14th. So they were making a reference to the statement that Marie Antoinette made about, in response to people starving in France, she said, let them eat cake. And so that's part of the reference we made in that video. But there were people dressed in black who were hissing at him. It was just in the midst of so much protest and disagreement from the audience. He was speaking to a crowd that didn't really want to hear his lies. And so we, in the middle of that, recognizing, one, the fact that this regime is a horror for humanity, that this is a fascist regime that we're living under, that we're being ruled by right now, and that this guy was responsible for the tax bill that's starving people to death with sanctions that, yeah, is imposing this tax bill on people that's further impoverishing people who are already impoverished. That's some of the agitation that we did in the video there. But we went there and we disrupted him. And we, within 30 seconds of speaking out, we were dragged out of the auditorium. We were arrested. We were held for 7 hours, and we were read a verbal notice from the chancellor by the UC Police Department that we were banned from the campus. And this is just, it's an illegitimate ban. It was never put in writing, and it gives us no way to contest it, and it's been arbitrarily enforced since then. And then the day after the event, Cowardly Mouse Mnuchin made an unprecedented demand to UCLA not to release the video of this program. It's a public program by a public official, and UCLA was complicit in suppressing this video from the public. And so, like we said there, we were challenging Mnuchin to a debate because the people did not get to hear him speak to our interjecting with the truth. And when we read that debate that very same day, we were arrested a few hours after reading that debate while we were standing in the lobby of a Chelsea Manning event, actually. And we were arrested as the UCPD reinforced this ban. So it's just been a very concentrated period of increased political suppression of people speaking out against this fascist regime. And that doesn't even include all of what happened in D.C., which we will hear about, too. Mm-hmm.
That's what I wanted to move into real quick. Emma, tell us what happened in D.C., because you were part of actually popularizing what was going on and the challenge to Mnuchin.
Yes. So me and a fellow activist, we went and read this challenge, the challenge that was read in the beginning, written by Tala, to challenge Steve Mnuchin to abate. It was verbal speech. We did not violate the law. It was the content of what we were saying that got us arrested by Secret Service for a verbal speech that challenged the Trump-Pence regime and the whole fascist program that Mnuchin is a part of, and he's a part of enforcing and carrying out. So we were held, we were pummeled by Secret Service. We were held for over 24 hours. We were in a holding cell, and then they moved us to a jail. And then while I was in detention, Homeland Security visited the home of my parents and asked about my political views and involvement with refusefascism.org. And it's a serious escalation in suppressing this message, targeting people who are speaking out against the regime.
Mm-hmm. So let's dig in this a little bit more because, you know, this point about actually one thing is it really is, you know, it is kind of unprecedented. You're not like 16 years old, you know, you're not somebody who is even living with your family, right?
Correct.
Yeah. And so somehow Homeland Security goes to your family's house to inform them that you are, oh, I don't know, what would they call you? A dissenter, a radical, a traitor to all that we hold true and dear? And the thing is this is something that has not happened. I don't remember this happening in a very, very long time. You know, this is something that people should really, your ears should be perked up and your eyes wide open when you hear this. They went to this sister's family's home and began questioning them about what she's doing, who she is, what she believes, and perhaps what are you willing to put up with? So let's talk about this a little bit more because it really is a sign of like this, you know, these are things, look, just basically, people should be outraged. No matter what else you think, people should be outraged that these particular assaults were made and upheld basically by the system. And people need to step up and say, no, this isn't right. So let's talk about this a little.
Yeah, so, I mean, it is excessive, you know? I mean, I know the U.S. government has a history of targeting activists and FBI and all of this. There's a whole history of this. But Homeland Security is an entirely different animal. You know, it was founded after 9/11. I won't get into a whole thing, but having the Department of Homeland Security, which, you know, mainly was dealt with 9/11 to deal with people who were accused of terror attacks, you know, this is saying that for nothing more than nonviolent speech, for nonviolent political speech. And this, I mean, this is exactly what, you know, I had a relative say to me, you know, I know what you've been talking to me about, you know, fascism. I know you've been talking about this, but now this really brings it home that this is what it is. And it's hitting people it hits you in a different way when it's you and the ones you love. You know, it sends a chill through your family, the people you love. People get scared. And, you know, one of the things that they said was they asked if my father was who's of Latino descent. They were asking about him. So this was meant to actually intimidate, to repress, and, you know, to send a chill through. If you express political speech, you know, this is what happens. You're going to become targeted. But in particular, the political speech of refuse fascism, because they were asking. They asked about my political affiliations, specifically what people knew about refusefascism.org. You know, so we can say more about that, but it's the, you know, today they're coming for me for saying a verbal challenging the regime. Tomorrow it's a radio show, you know, that's criticizing the regime. And next day it's professors who are saying things that people they don't like. Or just arresting people arbitrarily. I'm not saying this is exactly where this is going to go. We don't know. But this is the nature of fascism, and it is part of a pattern of, you know, targeting people who are speaking out, including immigrant rights leaders like Ravi Ravir, who I know you've had on your show, and others who are immigrant leaders who have been targeted for detention and deportation as part of trying to suppress the movement.
Mm-hmm. Tala, what happened to you in relation to this? Did you have any instance of the FBI or Homeland Security or anything? There any implications of them participating in what UCLA has done to you guys?
We don't have any indication of that, but just on the same page, we've been in contact with the chapter of Students for Justice in Palestine here, who says that they have been getting visits from the FBI. So it isn't just us. It is part of a broader pattern where these things are escalating.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and this is extremely important for people to know, because there is a question then of what people are going to do about this, right?
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. And what kind of things are being taken up at UCLA?
So here at UCLA, we're not accepting the ban. We've actually been defying the ban repeatedly in order to challenge Mnuchin to a debate. We actually had a screening not too long ago of a talk by Bob Avakian, which is called "The Trump-Pence Regime Must Go. In the Name of Humanity, We Refuse to Accept a Fascist America. A Better World is Possible." And that people should watch that on revcom.us. That sets the context for everything that we did. But we're trying to get this talk out among students. We actually, on the broadest level, we're trying to drive this regime out of power. We are trying to get millions of people out in the streets in sustained resistance, nonviolently, day after day and night after night, to really get these people out of power. And it's here they're coming down on the people who are speaking out at the same time as they're going after all these different sections of people, coming down with all kinds of horrific attacks, including what has been happening with immigrants in California. I just watched this really outrageous video. It was young women, young girls, were having their mother ripped from their arms. I think this was near San Diego. But ICE was taking the mother. They were putting her into the car as these young women were crying and crying. And all you could hear in this video was these women's screams. And it's outrageous, these things that are happening. It's not just numbers. It's been over 300 people in the past few weeks, but it's not just numbers. These are people's lives. And so it matters what we do in the face of all of this. It matters what we do when people stand up to challenge this, and when repression comes down on them. It matters that people stand with us, and that there's even more bold opposition to all of the things that this regime is doing and ultimately to drive this regime out of power. And so within that context, we are trying to mobilize students. We are delivering this, an open letter to repeal the ban to the chancellor on Monday. And so we're building for all of this. Trump is coming, and there will be a UCLA contingent of students that are opposing him there. But this is just all a part of getting people into the streets, getting people to really recognize that what we are facing is fascism. It is fascism with all of the horrors that that's going to mean, not only for the people here, but for the people all over the world, especially with this threat of nuclear war against North Korea. So people need to confront that, and people need to step up in the bold ways that we stepped up to oppose all of this and to stop all of this.
This is the Michael Slate Show, and I'm talking today with Tala from the Revolution Club at UCLA and Emma of Refuse Fascism. And we're talking about disrupting the fascist Steve Mnuchin and driving out the whole Trump-Pence regime. All right, Emma, let's talk with you a bit. You indicated that actually, you know, it's really important because that we understand actually that this, just what happened, I mean, I keep thinking about what happened to you as you're in jail and how they went to visit your parents, they checked up on you, all this other stuff, the threats that were given to both of you folks, and the idea, though, that people really have to, one, recognize that these are basic rights that people should not surrender, and that surrendering them actually does help in terms of the consolidation of fascist rule. And that's something that, you know, there's a link between these two things, between allowing this kind of assault on people to happen and then fascism consolidating itself. Let's talk about your views on that.
Yeah. I mean, I think one thing is that this, you know, the message that they were trying to suppress is this message that this is a fascist regime. That's why we went to deliver this challenge and debate, because it is a fascist regime. And a lot of times we have a lot of exposure on our website about why we say that this is so. But one of the hallmarks of fascism is the crushing of dissent and stripping away of civil liberties and traditional democratic rights. That is a hallmark of fascism. And so this is what this is. And part of why you have to go out and you have to challenge it is, you know, because it is only the actions of the people who can, I mean, one, we have to create a situation. They're testing the waters to see what people will accept right now on a lot of different levels. And it's extremely important that people go out and do that. But at the same time, we are the only organization that has said from the beginning that it is going to take millions of people in nonviolent mass action to actually drive this regime from power, you know, and there's a strategy and a plan and vision for doing that. And it's possible because of all the millions of people who hate this. I mean, you hear that message in the beginning, and that speaks to the sentiments of how millions of people who feel that this is a nightmare. And this is the objectively, you know, I don't know all of what's in Homeland Security's head or whatever, but objectively, this is what they're trying to suppress and what they don't want to be, what they don't want out in society. And it is illegitimate. Their repression is illegitimate. We are right. They are wrong. And right now, everyone who feels the same way, they have to come out and they have to defend this, because there is a window of time that we have to act. The fact that I'm not still in jail for, you know, the rest of my life, or that I wasn't executed, you know, that means that fascism has not completely consolidated yet. But, you know, all of the patterns are there, and we can't look away from it. We have to confront it, whatever political perspective you're coming from. And so people have to confront that, but also, you know, be part of this movement. Join Refuse Fascism. You know, sign up. We have a petition up on our website on refusefascism.org. We want thousands of people to sign on. We have a goal of 5,000 signatures by this weekend. Get out your phone right now. Go and sign on. And then learn about refusefascism.org. If you can volunteer an hour of your time, 2 hours, spread this. Start telling people we need to sound the alarm that in the name of humanity, we refuse to accept a fascist America. And don't be somebody that sees this and is listening to this now and you feel like something is wrong, but then not acting on it. We have to act on this together.
Mm-hmm. You know, there's a lot of examples in history, especially when you look back at things of how the Nazis came into power in Germany and how people kept thinking, it'll change. It'll change with the next election, or it'll change soon. These people can't last. And actually, by not standing up when it was necessary to fight back against this. They actually ended up enabling the consolidation of this regime that, you know, was responsible for the slaughter of millions of people across the world. And I think it's a lesson really worth heeding in relation to what we're talking about today. I want to ask one other thing. Actually, Tala, let's talk about this a little bit, because you mentioned this earlier about the work that you've been doing at UCLA's campus. And it's really important in terms of, I think, this one thing that you brought up. There's a point where you were, you know, people have to really demand that the kind of freedom to actually participate in open forums and to bring your thoughts and your ideas and your positions into practice in the university and anywhere else is absolutely necessary to fight for. And it is an important part about fighting against fascism. But you referred to this talk by Bob Avakian, the chairman of the Revolutionary Communist Party, which I think is really important for people to hear a little bit more about where, you know, what it is, if you can encapsulate it. I know it's difficult, but it's a really very powerful, very moving speech, and something that actually is, you know, lays bare all the dynamics that are going on. So let's talk about that a little bit.
Yes, I fully agree with what you said. I think that this is the most important work that we're doing on campus, is getting this talk out. And there is actually a point that's made in the talk. He gives this example. Someone asks, how can people actually stand up for what is right and make sacrifices in that context? And he says, I think they were talking about students in particular, but he talks about Kent State and how people were shot down. And in the face of that, all these students regrouped at a park nearby, and they were having a debate about whether they should go up against the National Guard at that point with the rocks and sticks that they had or whatever. And he says, look, the point isn't that we should go up against the National Guard, just to be clear, but how do people make sacrifices like that? Where do they find that courage and that bravery? And he makes a point that it comes from understanding what we're facing, from understanding the reality and the necessity to step out in those bold ways. And that is exactly the problem that we're facing. There are millions of people who despise all of what is happening, who wouldn't stand for all these immigrants being deported, but who are right now all too silent, or who are fighting just particular battles but are not recognizing the danger that this entire regime represents. And these are exactly the questions that Avakian gets into. Where did fascism come from in America? How is it so rooted so deeply with the male supremacy and the white supremacy and the American chauvinism? And can it actually happen here, fascism, which is a big question, even though more and more people are beginning to use this word and are beginning to somewhat confront the reality of what this is. But this talk gets deeply into the roots of this, and it gets deeply into how we can actually stop it, not just where it came from, but what are the contradictions that people are facing. What are the things that people have to confront right now in order for us to be able to be millions in the streets to get this regime out of power at the soonest possible time? And it makes a case for why that is exactly what's necessary.
Mm-hmm. And it is, I mean, look, when you're talking about getting millions of people into the streets, this is the challenge that's faced to the people alive during this time period in history. If we don't stand up and do something around this, all of humanity and perhaps the entire planet will pay the price, and that's not acceptable. And one more thing, I just want to, how can people get hold of you? What are you doing? How can they look to participate in this?
Who was the question to?
That was to Tala, and then I'm going to come right to Emma. So we have a couple minutes.
So people should follow on social media, tune into RevCom, and they should stay updated on RevCom.us. And we will post the actions that we're having, but people should work with refusefascism.org. We're coming from, as a revolution club, the perspective that this entire system of capitalism is rotten and that it all has to go, and people should really look into that. But people right now, we have to confront the reality that if we don't drive this regime out of power, that the prospects for fighting for a whole different world are going to be greatly blunted. And so we all have to put ourselves into those efforts and be a part of that fight.
All right. Emma, what can people do to take part in the activities and to express their support for Refuse Fascism?
We have chapters in the major cities around the country if you're listening somewhere else, and you can go to our website and get hooked up there. At the same time, what's really important wherever you are is to, we have a petition that's that the title of it is Drop the Charges on the RefuseFascism.org Activists and the Political Suppression. And it really matters if people sign that. When you sign that and spread it, it's actually not just signing a petition. You are part of, you know, thousands of people who will be sending the message saying that, look, if you come after these people, you're going to have to deal with these thousands and thousands and thousands of people. And they will measure what they do based on that. And we could actually, you know, defeat this and make them back off based on some of this. So I just really, and I hope maybe there's a way that you can put it up, Michael, but that people can easily access this petition on refusefascism.org. The second thing is to donate funds. Make a donation, $5, $10, do a bake sale, raise money. You can send the donations on our website, again, refusefascism.org. This is going to be a battle that's going to need funding for the lawyers, for the legal costs, for transportation, to build public support, all of this. The more funds we have, actually, the more the chances are we could win, and that we not only win just this particular case, but also to stop them, you know, to stop them from doing this, not just to us, but from everyone else, by growing this movement that is so needed for the 7 billion people on our planet.
Yeah, it's a battle that a battle for the future that has to be won. And if it isn't, the extinction of the planet is the actual possibility. So I want to thank both of you very much for joining us today.
Thank you.
Sure. Okay. And we'll be sure to keep in touch, all right, as things develop. So let's stay in touch. All right. All right. Now, I want to thank both Tala and Emma for joining us. Tala is from the Revolution Club at UCLA, and Emma is from Refuse Fascism. And that's basically, we should really, you know, people, we will have up on my site, we will have up on that site a posting of how you can actually get in touch with these organizations. It'd be good for people to do that and find out how you can fit in and what the hell is going on. And if you're not worried about what's happening, you're really tuned out on the universe. And if you're not standing up and trying to do something about it, you got a big problem. All right. So that's what we're talking about. Now, we're going to take a quick musical break and be right back. So stay tuned.
Was die Attentäter betrifft, die in Berlin den Anschlag auf die deutsch-arabische Gesellschaft verübt haben, ist die Polizei einen Schritt weiter gekommen. Der nach dem Anschlag.
They sentenced me to 20 years of boredom for trying to change the system from within. I'm coming now, I'm coming to reward them. First, we take Manhattan. Then we take Berlin.
Back, what a great song, right? Something we, again, just moves your heart, but also should move your head about the times that we're living in today. First, we take Manhattan. That was a song written by Leonard Cohen and sung by Jennifer Warnes. Right now, we're going to move into our second portion of the show, and it's a portion that's always very hard to do, but it's also very necessary. And I'm always really, 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 I find it very important to actually bring these kinds of things out to you, because we don't hear about them a lot, or we don't hear, we only hear one side, and that's usually the side of the system. And that is, we're going to be talking with the family members of A.J. Weber, who was killed by the sheriff's department. A.J. was a 16-year-old youth who happened to be out during right after the Super Bowl and happened to be gunned down because he was wearing dark pants, a dark shirt, and he was black. All right? And without any further ado, we're going to move right into this discussion I had with the family and friends of A.J. Weber, of the late A.J. Weber, just a few days ago. In 2017 alone, police across the country killed more than 1,100 people, and one quarter of them, 25% of them, were black. And they continue to do it again and again. On February 4th of this year, a young black man, a black youth, A.J. Weber, was murdered by L.A. County sheriffs. It was a heinous crime. Joining us here to talk about this are three people. We're joined by Stephanie, who is A.J.'s partner and the mother of their child, and John Weber, A.J.'s brother.
Proud to be here. Thanks for having me.
And Rodney, who is a longtime friend of A.J.'s.
How you doing?
All right, well, let's talk about this, because this was something that, when I heard about it, it made me extremely angry and extremely anxious to talk to people about what was happening. So I'm going to ask you first, John. Tell people what happened on the night of February 4th.
I was out, and I got a random call from my pops. It was unusual that he called me around this hour. So when I seen him calling, I answered, and he said something about my brother being shot and being dead. You know, it didn't get me going like that right at that point. It just like, oh, let me go see what's going on, because this is just like something just I didn't want to believe myself. So he said, I'm going and checking on it right now. So I made my way over there, too, to go see so I could verify what was going on. When I got there, it was police out. When I seen cars, so that alarmed me right then and there, like, oh, man, it's something. It is something. You know, and I was just hoping that it was, like, wrong information or something like that. I got out, and one of my older homeboys walked up to me, and I guess he had been on the scene for a little while already. He was looking at me, and he looked heartbroken, and I said, was my brother gunned down? And he said, yeah. I hopped in the car. I immediately thought it was, like, some gang members or something. I immediately thought that, and I left, and I just, like, try to collect my thoughts, and I ended up coming back and finding out that it was the police. It was the sheriffs. And upon me questioning them, I was disrespected by one of the officers. They had disrespected me as soon as I asked them, like, where's my brother? Where's AJ? Where's my brother? Officer told me in a foul manner. He said, it don't matter where your brother's at. I don't know what he was thinking at the time, but that's what he had told me. And some people from the neighborhood and the community, they had my back right there, and that wasn't a response that really we liked it. So they became alarmed based on us. And I couldn't even find out what was going on with my brother. I eventually was removed, and I was placed in a car, cop car, yeah. And I sat there until the whole community left, and then that's when they let me back out. Because I was somebody that could have incited something when they just killed my little brother. So that's how they decided to handle the situation, by putting me in the back of a sheriff unit for the duration of the time that this scene was going on.
Rodney, were you on the scene when this happened?
No, I got a call just like he said, saying the same thing, as in somebody then shot AJ. So I pulled up just like anybody else would, and I seen the whole block lit up and seen all the commotion and everything, got out, and they told me, confirmed me that's what happened.
Stephanie, how did you hear about this?
I was actually here. I was on the scene. So it was Super Bowl Sunday. I had took the baby to, you know, both sides of the family to go see, so they could see her for the Super Bowl. He was actually up here watching it, Super Bowl with, you know, friends, a little Super Bowl get together. We had already had plans to go eat dinner after the Super Bowl with the baby. So I had left the baby with his mom and came over here to pick him up, parked my car. I had already seen him walking towards the apartment, so I got out to go let him know I was here. We chit-chatted for a second. He said he had to go grab some stuff from upstairs to go to the car. He'll meet me there. And as I walk out of the apartment, I see the sheriff pull up. They pulled up in their vehicle, lights off, sound off. They parked in front of the driveway for the two apartments. And they went down the other apartment, though, the second apartment, not the one where AJ was killed at, but the other apartment. They went down that driveway. So I'm only parked two apartments down. So as I'm walking to the car, from the time the sheriff got there to the time I got to my car, which was probably less than a minute, I hear shots, 10, 12 shots. So I'm at the end of the driveway. I start moving towards the apartment. The shooting stops for a couple seconds, and all of a sudden it starts again, another 10 rounds. So then again, I started moving towards back to the apartment, and then it stopped. I'm not even thinking it's a sheriff because there's so many shots. I'm thinking if it is a sheriff, they got into it with somebody because there's too much shooting. There must have been multiple people shooting because it was that many shots. And as I'm walking back down the stairs, someone comes running saying that AJ was hit. So I start running, take off running from that apartment back to exactly where I was. And exactly where I left him standing alive, he was laying there shot. So I didn't get all the way inside. I got up to almost to the gate before I was stopped by a sheriff's deputy. I don't know why they keep saying that there was a bunch of people around that took the gun, because I was the only one running towards that scene. Nobody else was running towards an active shooting scene. The sheriff still had their guns out. At least one officer that I saw still had his gun drawn towards AJ. And there was the one that stopped me outside. Like, they keep pushing us back, but I keep saying it's as possible as I can see AJ. Now, when I saw AJ, he was breathing. He was alive. About 5 minutes passed, and the ambulance isn't here yet. And I'm trying to get information from the deputy as to what hospital he's going to. Because I'm still thinking, he's been shot. He needs to go to the hospital. We need to go to the hospital. I'm trying to figure out what hospital he's going to, so I can either ride along, I can let his family know, so we can all meet up at the hospital. They're not cooperating with me. Like I said, 5 minutes passed, I call 911 because there's no ambulance here. He's just laying there. I call 911, and 911 tells me that the ambulance are on standby because of the situation. I said, what do you mean they're on standby? He's been shot. He's bleeding. He needs help. They said, well, they can't go into the scene till the sheriff's clear it. I'm like, how are you just going to let him lay there if he's injured? And they said, there's nothing they can do. So I hung up on them. And I immediately started calling his mom, his dad, and everybody. And I'm still over here trying to press this issue about the ambulance. So they keep pushing me back. 20 minutes passed, the ambulance finally shows up. Again, this is about 20 minutes after the shooting. The ambulance finally shows up. But first, they're just sitting there. Finally, they start getting out of the car, and they get the gurney out. They get the tools out. A sheriff deputy walks up to them. I don't know what he tells them, but they immediately pack up and drive away. No paramedics got near AJ. They didn't make no effort to resuscitate him or keep him alive or anything. They left him laying there because I watched this whole time. When the ambulance got called away, his mom was already on the scene, and so she called me to go towards her. And she's the one that let me know that the sheriff's deputy said just let her know that he was officially dead. This is about 30 minutes after the shooting. Again, mind you, I didn't leave the scene till 5:30 the next morning. I stayed on scene till they removed AJ's body. They denied any medical access. They left him laying there, and then after he died, they left him laying on the floor. From 8:30 at night to 5:30 the next morning.
Now tell me this, the way these cops justify the murder, they murdered him in cold blood. They say that he went for a gun and that he was actually going to shoot at them and they had to do something. But somehow they just haven't been able to find the gun.
Right.
Let's talk about that a little bit.
Well, see, they haven't released the autopsy, but we did see his body before we got him prepared for the funeral and all that. We know for a fact he was shot in the back, about 8 times in the back, and then a bunch of other shots that looked like he must have been shot after he hit the ground.
There actually wasn't a gun. So
No, there wasn't a gun.
Yeah, so to touch bases with that, there wasn't no gun, period. So that's what's up with the gun situation. There's no gun.
That, on top of that, if there had any threat, I don't understand how they can say there was a threat to their life if he had his back turned. If he had his back turned and they hit him in the back, how could he have been reaching for him? How could he have been getting ready to shoot if they hit him in the back? If they thought he was getting ready to shoot, that means he must have turned around and reached for his waistband. You know what I mean? Like, it doesn't make sense that he would have been shot in the back that many times if he was already getting ready to face him to shoot. And then on top of that, there was not even a gun to begin with, and then he turned around. No. He was shot so many times in the back. How can you justify that as a threat?
John, I want to hear what you have to say about this, too. They said that he had a gun, but then they say that somehow the gun disappeared after they killed him. They say somehow the gun disappeared.
Right.
Somebody from the neighborhood came in and took it. So they're trying to turn all the stuff around and justify what they did. Let's hear what you have to say, John.
As far as I know, what they answer is to that is 30 to 40 people came and crowded my little brother and maybe possibly took the gun. This is since they're not really telling nothing about the investigation and they're making it a slow process so it kind of could just air out. I know the tactics of what they're doing, but that's the information that they say 30 to 40 people came out and took the gun from them. After interviewing some more people and after seeing that the community was being supportive in this situation, that the community really was the witness in this situation, they decided to switch the story up and say that it wasn't 20 or 30 to 40 people, that maybe it was a smaller number of people. So I don't know what's up with the information.
The sheriffs called AJ Ferenstown that night. They went about 2 in the morning to the sheriff's station. His mom let them know Stephanie was there. She gave them my name and my phone number. Never once did they come talk to me. All the witnesses that they had locked in the apartment that saw, we have someone that saw the whole shooting go down. They have not interviewed her. They have not interviewed anybody that stayed in the apartment. I don't know what witnesses they're talking to, but they're not talking to anybody that's here.
You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today about justice for AJ. Family members and a friend are speaking out about the police murder of AJ Weber, a 16-year-old black man murdered by sheriffs in Los Angeles on February 4th. Look, one of the things they always say when they kill somebody is that they shot at us or they pulled a gun out. But they weren't able to find any gun in relation to the murder of AJ, which it was a murder.
Right.
They couldn't find any gun.
They justified the shooting by saying it was a call and saying that it was somebody that fit my brother's description and that he turned away and he looked at like he was reaching for a firearm. But once he was shot, somebody came and grasped the gun or something like that. But by them not finding no gun, how can you support that statement? People don't run into a shooting situation. It's just the mind frame of the officers, the mind frame of the police department. It's the stereotypic behavior of how they do things, which led to them shooting my brother and actually murdering him.
They're going to say that they shot AJ in self-defense. Now, conveniently, they didn't have any camera on. They didn't have anything recording it. They didn't have anything.
I actually believe that they identified AJ and they went and killed him specifically. It could have been him or a group of other younger guys. It could have probably been him or maybe 3 or 4 other guys. And he ended up being one of those guys that was in that little stereotypic mindset that led to the murder. It's a lot of people that's looking like that. When me talking to the cops, they familiar with the area. They familiar with the driveway. They familiar with the courtyard. They familiar with the people that hangs there and lives there. My brother is part of this community and he lives around here. He goes to school around here. And his friends are around here and his families are around here. And at that time, he was at the Super Bowl. If you were in the Super Bowl watch, they was over there having fun enjoying the Super Bowl. And they said they got a call. That's what led to it. And they responded to somebody that looked it like him. And upon that, they came up with some blasphemous story about a gun that right. they couldn't retrieve. And in no situation that I've witnessed when someone's shot by the police, do somebody run to the body and grab the necklace off the body, rob them, grab their gun, molest them, or in the midst of a shooting? I mean, come on now, that's blasphemy. They send so much blasphemous stuff through the media, and it's just false propaganda based on my brother. Their lies is not going to be believed in this situation, particularly.
What's it like living in the neighborhood there?
It's fearful. You can't live. We try to come together and form a unity amongst the public. So we could have some type of family, some type of understanding, some type of network around amongst the people. But it's a constant battle with the law, for one. It's other things that it's a battle with, too. But in particularly in this case, and in a lot of cases, it's the oppression of the law. Them stereotyping the young blacks coming up. I was one of them. I still am right now. I gotta go back in fear for me getting pulled over and getting planted something on me. I got a fear for them saying I reached for something. When I'm coming into an encounter with an officer, I gotta be afraid of them shooting me, but saying that I reached for something that I never actually right. had. Their mindset on us is not to help us, particularly where we live at. I'm not saying that it's like that everywhere, particularly where we live at, and the people, the men, the husbands, the brothers, the uncles, the grandfathers, those guys, you know, they're subjected to this type of stereotypic oppression by the Los Angeles police and the sheriffs.
The way they treat it is as if you're a young black man, you're not allowed to be outside, especially if you're in a group of 2 or more. That's probable cause for them to stop, search you, harass you, regardless of what you're doing. 4th of July, we were just in front of the house, and police officers passed by, stopped, jumped out of the car, pulled up a flashlight, trying to search everybody. Apparently, you can't be at a family function because that's enough probable cause because you're young and black. This is before anything. This is before the shooting. Now we're talking about after the shooting. It's just gotten worse. Harassment is constant over here at the apartments where the shooting happened. Constantly, the sheriffs are coming to harass people, arrest people, try to put a bad name on everybody. They've arrested his friends, about 15 of them, 3 different times. None of them have ever had any type of gang affiliation attached to their name. So after the shooting, when they've arrested them for nonsense, and then they automatically attach a gang file onto them. They have no gang tattoos. They have no history of arrests or crime. But all of a sudden, they're gang members.
So they're going through the neighborhood, and they're arresting and harassing.
Arresting. They came and raided apartments. They had a search warrant, but the search warrant was for a specific apartment. They didn't touch that apartment. They touched neighboring apartments, including the one where AJ was watching the Super Bowl. They didn't have a warrant for that apartment because I looked at the warrant. The warrant is for specifically one apartment, and that's not the one they went into. They didn't touch that apartment.
They got a system.
They went into three other apartments and raided those apartments.
The system that they got is that they justify this probable cause behavior by putting everybody on probation. I'm not on probation. Everybody's not on probation. So when you're hanging out, are you in front of your house, or you know, you're stretching, having a jog around the block, and they ride up, they call themselves touching you. They call themselves walking up on you and grabbing you by your wrist and putting your hands behind you and patting your pockets and asking to see your waistband and disrespecting you and grabbing you in your private area. It's like, it's not right. It's not right when you're getting groped by an officer in your private areas and you're not on probation and you have to deal with it because maybe your friend is on probation for whatever reason. But since you're right there with him and this is your buddy, you can't jam the police up because they're going to jam him up even worse. It's a lot of stuff that they do. That's how they justify it. In this case, they try to justify it by the phone call. They try to justify it by the search warrant or whatever. But, you know, it's no justification in shooting somebody, a 16-year-old boy, in the back. My brother should have been identified as a minor. My brother should have been identified as somebody that they had knew. And it should have been handled appropriately. And it wasn't handled appropriately. Instead of handing the adolescence over to his parents for doing wrong, which it wasn't no wrong going on at that time, they decide to jam you up, associate you with a bad reputation, and build a paper trail on you that's later going to convict you at a stronger point when they can throw false allegations at you when you're an adult. So that's their whole mindset.
Even if you were to take any other story into account, which you can't because there was no gun. I mean, there's not. But let's just say for whatever reason, they really feared for their life. You can't tell me that you can justify one officer, because we know there was one officer just shooting. So there's two officers there, but only one did the shooting. One officer shot one full round of bullets. Stop to reload and shoot more. For not getting shot back at, because there was no shots fired back at them, how can you justify that many shots being shot to one person in the back?
By hate. They came with hate.
That's what I'm saying. So you
their
can't
police station.
That.
Has hate in the way that they do things
that he
is hate.
Medical access.
And
he wasn't given a shot to live. He wasn't given a shot to fight for his life.
It's just sad that it. My brother had to become victim of their system that's not really sufficient for the public and safe for the public. They break laws to catch people. They set people up to catch people, and they just do a lot of things. They even murder people. They rob people. And it's just sad that my brother had to become.
It's sad. It's outrageous. It's out, and it's
outrageous.
It's
infuriating.
Yeah, and it's enraging. Yeah, it's infuriating. That's exactly the right word. There's a situation that's going on now. People in the neighborhood have stood up around this. They've actually come out to meetings with the police, and they've called out the cops. They've done all this other stuff. What's the situation in the neighborhood now?
Well, we're just trying to mobilize,
trying to get
support, so we can show that this is not something that's going to be brushed up underneath the rug. So we're still at work. It's still people in the community that's concerned about this. It's people in the community that's not letting this go. And what we're doing is we're just collecting ourselves, and we're presenting a force that's going to seek results.
All right, Stephanie, what do you have to say about that?
We're not going to let this drop. We're not going to let them brush this under the table. They can continue to harass. They can continue to do everything they're doing. They can go ahead and try to slow everything down and stop us, but we're not going to let this be dropped. They're not going to get to brush this under the table like they do so many time and time again. There's not going to be another case like this just for the sake of getting justice for AJ. We're going to get justice now because we shouldn't have to wait. They can't justify what they did. They can harass us all they want, but we're not going to drop this just because they're harassing us. But I know his family's not going to drop it. I know the community's not going to drop it because it's outrageous. We shouldn't have to even be doing all this work because it's wrong. Because if the tables were turned and I had shot somebody, I would have already been behind bars while they investigate. Until I proved innocent or whatever, guilty, I would be behind bars or out on bail, not on paid leave.
All right. Now, Rodney, do you have anything you'd like to add to this in the last couple minutes?
I just don't like how the police like to switch things and turn things always and point bad to everybody that's black and young. As far as, like, paint the picture as in we all do wrong things and we all bad and we're just bad people. Like, none of us have a good heart. Which is, I don't like how they just paint that. And AJ was nothing like that. He was good, a good young man. He wasn't nothing like that. He wouldn't do nothing to even get killed or nothing like that from the police. So that's all I really got to say about that. Like, I don't, the guy that did it, he should feel, I don't know, karma should come back on him. And
John, let's talk about that town hall meeting. That town hall meeting that was held shortly after AJ was killed. Let's talk about what happened there.
Okay, yeah, we brought the community together, and the police, they were held to answer on the information that they knew and how they felt about the situation, and to answer publicly about the matter at hand and to disclose how they felt. And it just was a total disappointment. It was totally disrespectful. I mean, that we got to run around on big questions that needed to be answered. As far as these being captains and professionals that represent the law and the public safety, how their representation of the law was poor, about them, their expertise, and how they just try to play the public as fools was blasphemous. I actually got one real deep statement out of Christopher Bergner, which is the captain, which was, I think it was at the end of the meeting, he actually told us that we didn't deserve anything. He actually told us that it wasn't no change that needed to come about, that there wasn't no flaw in the system. After he was so evasive towards very, very important questions, when I finally decided to ask him how he felt about the statistical information that was brought to them and the concern that was brought by the community members and the concern that was brought by the family, he told that based on the information that he was collected at that time, that it wasn't nothing, that it was should have been changed and nothing should be due. And later, he cleaned it up in the paper in the Los Angeles Times. Everybody got what he really said, but how can you be a man and not come back and apologize? How can you be a man and stand before the law and feel that you're withholding the law and not come with for correction? You know, they say that, well, I read it myself. It says that he thought I said we were doomed instead of due. I spelled it out for him, D-U-E. He didn't even correct himself at the time. So it wasn't no inclinations that he made a mistake during that time. But he caught himself cleaning it up in the paper for the press. Wasn't no formal apology made to the family. Wasn't no formal apology made to the community. He exposed his hand as far as how he feels. And he's not somebody that needs to be dealing with these type of situations or our community, period. He needs to be removed and he needs to be placed somewhere where his abilities can be utilized more sufficiently. But in this aspect, he cannot does no change. He cannot do no help.
All right, Stephanie, did you have anything you want to add real quick?
The town hall was ridiculous. It's like John said, they were just avoiding every question. I mean, I don't even know why they agreed to do it. They were completely avoiding all the questions. They didn't give us any answers. They didn't give us any information. I mean, like, we asked for the officer's name. They said it's public record, but they're not going to give it to us. So how is it public record? They just avoided every question. Every question was answered with the typical, you know, due to investigation, we can't answer it. And, I mean, I was there. John made that question very clear. He repeated it multiple times, and he spelled out due to him. In his face. There's no way that was like that he misheard that question, because John repeated it multiple times, slowly, clearly, spelled it out. Mm-hmm. He slipped up and said what he really felt about the situation. That's where he messed up. He didn't mishear the question. He just really let us know how he felt about the situation.
All right, we'll take one more comment from each of you. So, Stephanie, why don't we go with you first? Where do you think things are going to go now? Where do you see things going now? Things stand now?
Realistically, I'm expecting the harassment to continue and get worse. They're very obviously trying to intimidate us to stop, to be quiet. I mean, they've told some of the guys have been arrested pretty clearly. We'll let you go, you know, if you give us something. Of course, they're never going to admit to that. And of course, they do that when they're behind bars, so there's no way we can record them or none of that. It's always going to be our word against our theirs, and they're just going to deny it like they do everything else. But, I mean, it's pretty clear. They're going to continue to talk to us and harass us until we drop this. Because they can't justify this. I don't expect it to get any better.
All right, John, what about you?
how I feel about how things are going to be, I think that maybe things will be the same. I think that it's going to take a little fight for things to change. I think that in AJ's case, I think that we are going to make some changes. I think that there's no option for compromise in this situation. And I believe that things are going to come to pass and justification is going to come through because it's only right. So that's where my faith is and that's where my heart is. And there, it ain't no excuses.
All right.
It ain't no excuses.
All right. Now, let me ask you both this. Is there a Facebook group or some way that people who want to support you and find out more about this, that they can get in touch with you?
Well, we have the GoFundMe page, and you can comment, and we respond there as well. We don't have, like, a page up yet, but I'll work on doing, like, a little page so we can have people reach out to us there, too.
Okay, definitely.
Justice for AJ, though.
Justice for AJ.
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely.
Justice for AJ.
Absolutely. All right. Thank you all very much, and I will be following this with you. Justice for AJ. Never forget that. And people need to find out more about that. All right. And the police have already responded to the murder of AJ by terrorizing the community, further arresting 15 local people. And that brings us to the end of yet another show. I want to thank all of my guests today, Emma and Tala, and the family and friends of AJ Weber. I also want to thank my assistant producer, Henry Carson, my production assistant, Jeff Pryor, and the engineer today, Kiana Williams. And I want to thank each and every one of you for tuning in. And if you want to write to me, you can at mslate@themichaelslateshow.com. Once again, that's mslate@themichaelslateshow.com. We're going to go out now with Revolutionary Dream from Pablo Moses. Talk to you again next week.
Oh yeah, oh la la, now. Oh oh oh, now. A revolutionary dream, people listen keen. Freedom fight, I was my dream. I was on this mountain with other soldiers, awaiting orders for attack, the oppressor's voice. Whoa, 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 hoy. Whoa, 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 hoy. Hoy. In this particular dream, the time was night. A time we knew we had to fight. A revolutionary dream, people listen keen. Freedom fight, I was in my dream. Did not want to fight our brothers, but we had to, because they were traitors. Why? Why, why, why? Why, why, why? Why? We knew not when this war would end, but our freedom we had to defend. Yeah. Oh, oh, la, oh, yeah.